Picture the scene. It is September 27th, 2026. A Sunday night, you are walking into a dimly lit pub or, maybe one of those rented out community halls.
Oh, yeah, the ones that always smell faintly of like floor wax and old coffee.
Exactly. And the air is just thick. It smells like spilled cider, tension, and frantically erased whiteboard markers.
Because you are walking into a trivia night.
Right, but instantly, this isn't just any general knowledge pub quiz. You can't just coast by remembering the capital of Australia or like the drummer for the Beatles.
No, absolutely not. You glance around the room, and the stakes are visibly incredibly high. The competition is
The
fierce.
murmurs are hushed, right? And the subject tonight is highly specialized. You are here to face down a gauntlet based entirely on Callie Hart's mega hit Fae and Alchemy series.
Specifically, they are drilling into the lore, mechanics, and the intricate portrayals of the first two books. So that is Quicksilver and Brimstone.
And you can physically feel the pressure in that room because the people sitting at the tables around you haven't merely read these books in passing.
Oh no, they have inhabited them.
Yeah.
I mean, they're the types who have annotated the margins of their hardcovers until the pages are just totally crinkled.
Yeah, they have spent years debating the specific mechanics of like alchemical transmutation on obscure forms. They trace lineages, they cross-reference maps.
They're out for blood, and
Right.
they are expecting the quizmasters to be equally merciless.
Which is exactly why we are your secret weapon for this deep dive. We are pulling from an exhaustive, legendary consolidation of knowledge that the most dedicated corners of the fandom have meticulously built.
We're talking about a compilation that doesn't just summarize the plot. Because, I mean, anyone can read a Wikipedia summary, right?
Exactly. This cross-references, published recaps, official publisher metadata, and incredibly nuanced fan wikis to bulletproof every single fact.
It even documents the typographical disputes where the fandom genuinely disagrees on the spelling of a vampire lord's name.
It is a masterwork of specialized lore. But navigating a trivia night of this caliber requires a very specific mindset.
It really does. Memorizing a sterile list of names and geographical locations is a fundamental baseline, but that will only get you through the lightning round.
Right, because the architects of these quizzes, the true trivia masters, they are actively trying to trap you.
Oh, for sure. They are hunting for the overlapping facts, the deceptive naming conventions, and those massive plot twists that feature three or four intersecting magical mechanics.
So to actually win, to ensure you don't get knocked out in round three, you cannot just know what happened. You have to understand the underlying architecture of the world building.
You need to grasp why the magic functions the way it does, and how the geopolitics dictate the character psychologies.
Because the teams that crash and burn are the ones who fail to spot the underlying patterns, the cause and effect relationships holding this universe together.
So let's unpack that architecture. Our mission for this deep dive is to map the board so intricately in your mind that no trick question can trip you up.
No matter how maliciously phrased it is, we are going to build this world from the bedrock up.
Because before we can even begin to dissect the ancient magics, or, the blood oaths binding characters to Hellgates, we have to understand the physical landscape.
We need to analyze the three distinct realms, because geography in this series isn't just a backdrop, it is destiny.
Geopolitics is the absolute foundation of any high-stakes fantasy trivia. If you don't know the board, you can't track the pieces.
So true. And in Callie Art's universe, the reality is fractured into three completely isolated, highly distinct territories.
Each ruled by a monarch whose personality basically mirrors the harshness of their environment.
The logical starting point, because it is where our protagonist originates, is the mortal realm. So let's look at Zilverin.
Zilverin. It is a bleak, unforgiving place. It is defined as a walled desert city.
And when we say desert, we aren't talking about a picturesque landscape of rolling dunes.
No, we are talking about a brutal, desiccated environment where water is fiercely rationed by the ruling class.
But the defining economic characteristic of Zilverin, the detail that really drives the entire plot, is that metal is incredibly precious.
It is a realm of absolute scarcity, ruled with an iron fist by Queen Mundra.
And this is the crucible where we meet our heroine, Ceres Phaon. She is a 24-year-old mortal, and she is a thief.
But she isn't stealing for the adrenaline rush,
Right, so.
or out of some romanticized rogue archetype, right?
Right. She is operating in the Third Ward, which is essentially an impoverished, plague-ridden slum, and she is stealing purely to keep her younger brother, Hayden, alive.
The environmental and economic realities of Zilverin are not just set dressing. They are the key to understanding Ceres's entire psychological profile.
Absolutely. When you have a society where water is tightly rationed and metal is treated as a precious commodity, you are looking at extreme, brutal scarcity.
Every single decision made in the Third Ward is a literal life or death calculation. It strips away morality and replaces it with pure survival mechanics.
And the specific scarcity of metal is deeply ironic. I mean, it is immensely important thematically, considering the latent magical abilities Ceres possesses.
Exactly. Her formative years as a street thief are what forge her tactical mind. She learns to observe, to hoard, to strike quickly, and to protect her brother at any cost.
You just cannot separate the harshness of the Zilveran Desert from the sharp edges of her personality.
I look at the economy of Zilveran, and it feels less like traditional high fantasy and much more like a post-apocalyptic survival scenario.
Yes. It is essentially Mad Max mechanics operating inside a walled medieval city.
You don't have these sweeping, lush green pastures or noble knights.
Yeah.
You have dust, absolute desperation, and a hoarding ruling class.
Looking down on a plague-ridden underclass, it forces a certain ruthlessness. But the contrast hits you like a physical blow when you cross the boundary into the second realm.
The Fey territory of Yvelia.
Geographically, atmospherically, and magically, Yvelia is the absolute inversion of Zilveran.
Where the mortal realm is a baking, impoverished desert, the Fey realm is a frozen, mountainous expanse.
It is a world encased in snow and ice. Visually beautiful, but incredibly hostile. And it is embroiled in a perpetual, grinding war.
And the sovereign of this frozen realm is King Bellicon.
And right here, this is where we encounter the very first major trap that you will face on Trivia Night.
Oh, it's a trap that catches casual readers incredibly consistently.
Mm-hmm.
And it revolves entirely around the climates of these two realms.
There is a specific phonetic misdirection happening here. A mnemonic to lock into your brain right now is Z for scorched.
Z for scorched. Zilveran is the desert. Yvelia is the ice.
A skilled quizmaster will intentionally try to exploit the phonetic assumptions you make in your head.
They will construct a question that subtly implies or tries to lead you into thinking that Yvelia is the sun-baked wasteland.
It is the fastest, easiest way to cull the herd in the first round of a trivia tournament. You have to anchor yourself to Z for scorched.
Because if you lose your grip on which realm is which, your understanding of the magic system and the resource wars just completely collapses.
But let's analyze why people get this wrong, because honestly, I completely understand the confusion here.
Oh, totally.
I mean, Yvelia sounds like a warm, lush, tropical vacation destination. It phonetically rolls off the tongue like a place where you'd be sipping a cocktail on a pristine beach.
Right. And conversely, Zilveran sounds sharp, harsh, cold, and metallic. It sounds like the name of a frozen, impenetrable fortress.
So the author has engaged in this deliberate, brilliant linguistic misdirection. She gives us a scorching desert and names it Zilveran, and she gives us a freezing ice box and names it Yvelia.
You are fighting your own phonetic instincts. It is a masterclass in challenging reader expectations.
But beyond the names, look at the stark contrast in resources. In the mortal desert of Zilveran, metal is scarce to the point of being a luxury currency.
Right, but in the Fey icecape of Yvelia, metal is not just abundant. It is the fundamental physical medium through which their ancient magic operates.
This creates a massive imbalance. The scarcity in the human world directly contrasts with the magical and material abundance in the Fey world.
It establishes the power dynamic before a single spell is even cast. The mortals are essentially living in the dirt, while the Fey are sitting on the very resource that powers the universe.
Which provides the perfect bridge to the third realm on our map. Stannisroth?
Yes, Stannisroth. This is the domain of the vampires. And the sovereign ruling over this kingdom is King Malcolm.
Malcolm, I have to say, that is such an aggressively normal, mundane name for an ancient vampire king.
It absolutely is, and that is a detail you can weaponize for trivia. The stark contrast of his name is a deliberate choice.
Think about how a multiple choice question might be structured here. They might ask for the name of the vampire king and give you four options.
Three of them will likely be these flowery, overly complex, multisyllabic high fantasy names, and then the fourth option will just be Malcolm.
If you understand the author's tendency to undercut expectations, you immediately know Malcolm is the right answer.
So your mental map is set. You have Zilveran, the mortal desert of scarcity ruled by Madra.
You have Yvelia, the frozen Fey mountains of magical abundance ruled by Bellicon. And you have Stannisroth, the vampire kingdom ruled by Malcolm.
Three highly distinct, segregated worlds. But this is where the mechanics of the universe become incredibly fascinating.
Because these worlds are segregated, but they are connected, or perhaps infected is a better word.
Yeah, infected by a highly volatile, immensely powerful substance. It is the engine that drives the entire narrative economy of the series.
Let's delve into the mechanics of alchemy and Quicksilver.
This is the nucleus of the magic system. And the most critical thing to understand is that alchemy, in this specific universe, is classified as a dead magic.
Right. When we hear the word alchemy, we usually think of a wizard mixing strange liquids in a beaker or trying to turn lead into gold.
But here, it is vastly more complex and significantly more dangerous. First, it explicitly requires fey blood as a catalyst. Mortals cannot simply learn it by reading a book.
Secondly, because the knowledge has been lost for centuries, it is a depressed magical economy.
Historically, when this magic was alive and functioning, it was divided into the three distinct branches: immortality, transmutation, and healing.
And those branches explain why the entire geopolitical landscape suddenly destabilizes over a 24-year-old mortal thief from the impoverished slums of Zilverin.
Seer's Fane isn't just an anomaly because she is an alchemist in an era of dead magic. She is singular because she possesses an unprecedented mutation.
She can control all five of the alchemical metals. It isn't just a matter of waving a wand. She has a visceral sensory connection to the elements.
She can literally hear the metal singing to her. She can manipulate it at a molecular level.
Let's look at the implications of that. You have a world where the most powerful form of magic has been dormant, basically extinct, for generations.
The entire power structure of the three realms has settled into a status quo based on that absence.
And then, completely out of nowhere, a mortal woman appears who holds an absolute monopoly on the most valuable, destructive, and restorative resource in existence.
She instantly becomes the most hunted commodity across all three realms. The Fae want her, the vampires want her, the mortal queen wants her.
Because Ceres is the skeleton key. She is the only mechanism capable of unlocking the true dormant power of the world.
And the absolute zenith of that power, the most dangerous substance she can manipulate, is Quicksilver.
If you want to survive the trivia night, you have to understand Quicksilver intimately. It is described fundamentally as a living metal.
And the massive trap that quizmasters love to deploy revolves around what we can categorize as the three jobs of Quicksilver.
It is the ultimate multiple choice nightmare because Quicksilver doesn't just do one thing. It serves three distinct, overlapping, and massive functions within the narrative architecture.
If you only remember one, you fail the question. So let's break down the mechanics of those three jobs.
The first function of Quicksilver is spatial manipulation. It acts as a literal door.
Right. It has the capacity to tear open portals across dimensions, bridging the isolated realms.
We see this violently demonstrated early in Book One. Ceres is being subjected to torture in the mortal realm of Zilverin.
In a moment of sheer panic and survival instinct, her latent magic flares. She instinctively manipulates the metal in her environment to defend herself, ripping a sword from a platform.
The intense magical reaction causes the very floor beneath her to liquefy and transform into a Quicksilver gate.
She falls through, and that spatial tear is exactly how she is transported from the scorching desert into the freezing Fey realm of Yvalia.
It's an explosive, uncontrolled use of the magic. So job one is dimensional portals. Job two is metallurgical.
Quicksilver is the essential raw material used to forge relics. But not just any relics. Specifically, the God Swords.
These are ancient cataclysmic weapons that were forged centuries ago by the original alchemists.
We are going to discuss a very specific, highly important God Sword a bit later, but the takeaway here is that Quicksilver is the foundational element required to create weapons of mass destruction.
It isn't just a shiny metal. It is weapons-grade magical material.
And that leads directly to the third job of Quicksilver, which is arguably the most insidious and the one that drives the deepest emotional and psychological plot lines.
Quicksilver poisons the mind.
It is highly toxic, but not in a simple physical way. Prolonged exposure to it, or attempting to wield it without the specific genetic and magical safeguards of an alchemist, slowly and agonizingly degrades your sanity.
It literally eats away at your cognitive function. And the tragic figure who serves as the prime example of this degradation is the male lead, the Fey commander Kingfisher.
When Ceres first encounters him, he isn't just a stoic warrior. He is a man who is actively, progressively being destroyed from the inside out by Quicksilver poisoning.
He is a ticking clock of cognitive collapse. The analogy I always come back to when trying to conceptualize Quicksilver is that it is the high fantasy equivalent of uranium.
Oh, that is a great way to think about it.
Think about the parallels. Uranium is incredibly powerful. It possesses the capacity to generate immense world-altering energy.
Just as Quicksilver can tear open portals across space and time or forge god-level weapons.
Right. But because of that immense power, it requires extreme, specialized, hazardous material handling protocols.
If you are exposed to uranium without protection, the radiation degrades your biology.
If you are exposed to Quicksilver without the singular ancient bloodline magic of an alchemist, the magical radiation, the poison, literally rots your brain.
It is the ultimate double-edged sword. It offers supreme power, but exacts a devastating biological and psychological cost on anyone unauthorized to use it.
The uranium analogy is highly effective for understanding the risk-reward ratio, but there is a nuance in the lore that forces us to question that analogy.
And this is exactly the kind of deep lore theorizing that separates casual readers from trivia champions. The texts explicitly define Quicksilver as a living metal.
If we take that description literally, it raises profound questions about the nature of this poisoning.
With uranium, the poisoning is passive. It is a chemical, radiological degradation. The rock doesn't possess malice. It doesn't hate you.
Right. It is simply radiating energy according to the laws of physics. But if Quicksilver is alive, is the cognitive collapse merely a biological reaction to a foreign magical substance?
Or is the metal actively and intentionally attacking Kingfisher's mind? Is there a consciousness within the Quicksilver that is actively hostile to those who try to harness it without the proper authority?
Oh, that completely shifts the horror of the situation. It means it isn't radiation sickness. It's a parasite or a predator.
And there is a massive critical piece of lore that fundamentally supports your theory. It is a revelation that comes later, but we need to connect the dots now.
We discovered that the spirit of Adina, who is Kingfisher's own mother, is actually living inside the Quicksilver.
She exists within the metal, speaking in riddles. If human or fae spirits can inhabit or be trapped within the molecular structure of the metal, then the poisoning Kingfisher is experiencing might not be chemical at all.
It might be a psychic assault from a chorus of trapped, agonized souls.
Precisely. And grasping that distinction changes your entire understanding of the magic system. Quicksilver is no longer just a dangerous tool or a volatile element.
It is an entity. It is a vessel. Understanding that subtle but massive difference in the world building is how you anticipate the hardest questions a trivia host can throw at you.
It changes how you view every interaction Sirius has with the metal.
All right, we have mapped the geography, and we have dissected the highly volatile, potentially haunted radioactive magic system. Now, we have to meet the specific characters caught in this web.
And for the purposes of dominating a trivia night, we need to focus heavily on typography, because spelling counts.
Oh, absolutely. In high-stakes trivia, a misspelled name is a wrong answer, and the host will ruthlessly dock your points. You have to know the roster, and you have to know how to spell them.
The spelling traps in this series are notorious. Let's begin with our protagonist, Sarah Sfain.
Phonetically, it seems straightforward, but the spelling is S-A-E-R-I-S. The trap is that A-E vowel combination in the middle.
I can virtually guarantee that someone sitting at the table next to you is going to write S-E-A-R-I-S, spelling it like the word sear, as in searing heat.
And the judge is going to draw a big red line through it. It is S-A-E-Cirrus.
She is the mortal thief, and her inciting incident, the moment that kicks off the entire plot, is a fantastic specific detail you need to remember.
She steals a golden gauntlet from a guardian in order to protect her brother Hayden.
Then we move to her mentor, the blacksmith operating in the slums of the Third Ward, who essentially raised her and taught her how to survive.
His name is Elroy, spelled E-L-R-O-Y. Now, this is a fascinating meta-trivia trap. You must be careful if you are doing independent research online.
Because several prominent summary sites and early fan postings contain a persistent typo, listing his name as Ellery with the O and R flipped.
Do not fall for the internet's typo. The text is definitive. It is Elroy.
Next on the board is the Fae Commander. He's known almost exclusively as Kingfisher, often abbreviated to just Fisher.
As the lore dictates, it is spelled exactly like the bird. There is no tricky fantasy spelling there. However, his true name, that is an entirely different beast.
The revelation of his true name is a massive tectonic shift in Book 2, and it represents a significant spelling hurdle.
His true name is Kaidan Greystar Finvara, but the quiz questions will almost certainly focus on his first name. Khyda.
It is spelled Khyda. The crucial detail to memorize is that it begins with a somewhat silent, aspirated KH.
If you write down Khyden, like you are naming a trendy toddler at a suburban playground, you're going to lose the point. Khyden.
And then we have his sister, Everlane, or Eve for short. This presents another subtle spelling trap.
It is spelled Everlayne. The suffix is Layne. It is not Laine with an I, and it is not Lane without the Y. You must include the Y.
And bringing Everlane into the conversation leads us directly to the threshold of what is arguably the single most convoluted, confusing, and frequently tested piece of lore in the entire series.
It is the family tree. If you retain absolutely nothing else from this deep dive, memorize the mechanics of this family.
This is the exact intersection where sweeping geopolitical drama collides with incredibly deep personal generational trauma.
We need to meticulously, step by step, break down the exact relationship between King Bellicon of Yvalia, Kingfisher, and Everlane.
The ultimate family tree trap. I have seen entire trivia teams implode over this one question. Let's take it very, very slowly and map the branches.
Good idea.
We begin with King Bellicon. He's the absolute ruler of the frozen Fey realm of Yvalia. Kingfisher is his top military commander.
Right.
However, Kingfisher is not his biological son. Kingfisher is Bellicon's stepson. Bellicon is, however, biologically the father of Everlane. Bellicon only entered Kingfisher's life through marriage.
Wait, I need to jump in here and play devil's advocate for the listener because my head is already spinning and we need absolute clarity on the mechanics of this lineage.
Go for it.
Let me repeat this back to ensure the architecture is sound. There is a woman named Adina. Adina is Kingfisher's biological mother. King Bellicon marries Adina.
Correct.
By marrying Adina, Bellicon officially becomes Kingfisher's stepdad. Following the marriage, Bellicon and Adina conceive a child together. That child is Everlane.
Still with you.
Therefore, Everlane is Bellicon's biological daughter, and she is Kingfisher's maternal half-sister. Do I have the mechanics right?
Your architecture is perfectly sound.
Yeah.
Everlane and Kingfisher share a biological mother in Adina. They are siblings. But King Bellicon shares absolutely no blood relation with Kingfisher.
But here is where the lore gets incredibly dark and convoluted. The histories state that Bellicon destroyed Fisher's family. So let's trace the logic of that trauma.
Right.
Bellicon marries Adina. He has a child with her. But somehow, through his tyrannical ambitions, he completely ruins the family structure.
And the result is that Kingfisher is now essentially conscripted, forced to serve as a military commander in his abusive stepdad's army.
And while he is serving this man he despises, his stepdad's magical quicksilver is slowly rotting his cognitive functions. It is no wonder the fandom spends so much time untangling this.
It is the ultimate toxic blended family nightmare. It is genuinely Shakespearean in its levels of toxicity and betrayal.
And when we connect this highly personal trauma to the broader geopolitical landscape, it illuminates everything about Kingfisher's psychology.
It explains his severe antagonism, his repressed rage, and his complicated loyalties. He isn't just a loyal soldier following orders.
He's a trapped, enslaved stepson serving the very monarch who orchestrated the destruction of his mother's life.
And it circles back to our earlier theory. His mother, Idina, is the spirit currently trapped within the quicksilver that is poisoning him.
The psychological layering of that torment is wild. Wielding a weaponized metal that contains the soul of your abused mother, which is actively degrading your mind while you serve her abuser. That is a staggering piece of world building.
As a trivia competitor, you have to know the precise terminology of this lineage cult. The quizmaster will project a question on the screen. What is Kingfisher's exact relation to King Bellicon?
If you panic and write son, you get a zero. He is the stepson.
This specific tangled lineage is the quintessential example of how the romanticy genre constructs its world building. The massive sweeping external conflicts, the wars between the realms, the magical plagues, the collapsing dimensions.
They're almost always driven by and mirrored in deeply intimate, highly dysfunctional family dynamics. The macro politics are always fueled by micro traumas.
You are absolutely right. The political is deeply personal. But if we think Bellicon's toxic blended family secrets are shocking, they pale in comparison to the massive continent-spanning geopolitical conspiracy that drops at the climax of Book One.
We thought the step-parent dynamic was complicated. We need to analyze the triumvirate.
This is the central tectonic twist of the novel Quicksilver. It is a revelation that forces you to reevaluate every single political interaction that occurred in the previous 400 pages.
In trivia circles, they refer to this as the panic button fact. It is the piece of lore you review in the car park right before you walk into the venue.
The revelation is this. King Malcolm, the ruler of the vampires, King Bellicon, the ruler of the Fae, and Queen Madra, the ruler of the mortals.
They are siblings. It is a phenomenal twist.
The sovereigns of three completely distinct, racially segregated, supposedly warring realms are actually brothers and sister. They share a bloodline.
They have been secretly colluding for centuries, orchestrating a massive shadow government to control the entire known world.
It completely shatters the illusion of the geopolitical board we mapped earlier.
It is exactly like discovering that the CEOs of three fiercely competing global megacorporations, companies that are actively trying to destroy each other in the marketplace, are actually three brothers secretly meeting in a boardroom to price fix the entire global economy.
They are managing the illusion of competition while their employees literally bleed and die in the trenches of this fabricated war.
It entirely recontextualizes the history of their world. The endless border skirmishes, the rationing of resources, the animosity between the races. It isn't a real war.
It is a cynical mechanism for population control. It is a grand, bloody stage play managed by three immortals who realize that eternal conflict is the most efficient way to maintain an absolute grip on power.
Because as long as the mortals, fae, and vampires are terrified of each other, they will never look up and realize their monarchs are playing them against one another.
So how does a centuries-old conspiracy of that magnitude finally unravel? It all detonates in the climax of Book One, and the sequence of events is so mechanically dense that it is a goldmine for trivia traps.
The dominoes start falling when Everlane, who remember is Bellicon's biological daughter and Kingfisher's half-sister, is kidnapped by King Malcolm, the Vampire King.
Which, armed with our new understanding of the Triumvirate, reveals a horrifying familial layer. This is not a geopolitical kidnapping. This is an uncle kidnapping his own niece to leverage power against his brother.
Exactly. The betrayal is incredibly intimate. Saris and Kingfisher track them down, descending into Malcolm's subterranean labyrinth, and that is where the grand conspiracy is finally laid bare.
But for our purposes, the actual physical mechanics of how they defeat King Malcolm is the crucial differentiator you need to study.
Because the victory relies on a character who, up until this exact sequence, appeared to be nothing more than a peripheral side player, Carrion Swift.
Carrion Swift is masterfully utilized misdirection by the author. He's introduced as a smuggler, he is Saris's ex-boyfriend, and for most of the narrative, he functions as the charismatic, slightly unreliable comic relief.
But the labyrinth sequence drops a massive biological reveal. Carrion is actually the secret, unrecognized heir to the very first ancient royal Fae bloodline. His genetics are incredibly rare.
During the chaotic fight in the labyrinth, King Malcolm, acting on pure vampiric instinct, fights Carrion. He attempts to feed on him.
But because Carrion possesses this ancient, highly concentrated royal Fae blood, the biological reaction is disastrous for the vampire.
Carrion's specific blood type acts as a highly virulent systemic poison to Malcolm. It immediately and severely weakens the Immortal King.
And here is the exact trivia trap. The quizmaster will ask, who is responsible for the death of King Malcolm in the labyrinth?
If you answer Carrion Swift, assuming the royal blood poison killed him, you will be marked wrong. The poison incapacitated him, but it did not execute him.
Saris executes him. Saris lands the final killing blow, but the mechanism of how she is able to kill a weakened immortal requires you to memorize a very specific sequence of magical events.
She doesn't just stab him with a regular dagger. First, she has to secure an enchanted coin.
But this coin isn't just lying on a table. She has to physically extract it from a creature known as the Morthal.
The Morthal. This is a vital piece of esoteric lore. Let's explain the mechanics of this extraction. What is the function of this enchanted coin?
The coin acts as a magical containment vessel. Releasing the coin from the Morthal triggers a massive magical chain reaction that frees a multitude of trapped souls.
And it is that specific magical shift, the release of kinetic spiritual energy from the trapped souls, that catalyzes Saris's power.
It enables her to finally wield one of those ancient alchemical weapons we discussed earlier. She is able to ignite a god sword.
And the specific name of that god sword is Solas. She wields Solas, and she physically beheads King Malcolm.
Let's synthesize that entire sequence, because it is a brilliantly constructed puzzle box of overlapping magical and political reveals.
In the span of one scene, you have the political paradigm shift. The rulers are siblings.
You have the biological lineage reveal. Carrion possesses toxic royal blood.
And you have the complex magical mechanics. Freeing trapped souls from the Morthal generates the necessary spiritual frequency to ignite a god sword named Solas.
Every single piece of lore established in the first 300 pages clicks together to create the execution. It is breathtakingly paced.
So Malcolm is dead, decapitated by Solas. But the cost is immense. Ceres sustains fatal injuries during the confrontation.
As she is bleeding out, the narrative shifts into an entirely new metaphysical gear, leading to her rebirth and setting the political status quo for Book Two.
As Ceres hovers on the edge of death, the Quicksilver itself establishes a direct psychic connection with her. The metal literally speaks to her consciousness.
It offers her a choice, asking if she truly wishes to remain tethered to the realm of Yuvalia. When she consents, her consciousness is pulled from the physical labyrinth and transported into the divine realm.
And the trivia points you need to harvest from this sequence are the specific names of the divine entities she encounters. She is met by twin goddesses, and their names are Baal and Mithin.
But they are not alone. She also encounters Xerath, who is explicitly the god of chaos. These three divine beings assess her, and to maintain cosmic equilibrium, they offer her a resurrection.
But resurrection in this universe is never a simple reset. She returns to the mortal plane, fundamentally and biologically altered.
She does not come back as a human alchemist. She is reborn as an unprecedented genetic anomaly, the first ever half-fae, half-vampire hybrid.
Which sets up the final massive trick question regarding the climax of Book One. The Quizmaster will undoubtedly ask, at the conclusion of Book One, which throne does the newly resurrected Ceres claim?
Now, if you are a casual reader, you might guess she takes over Yuvalia because she is deeply entangled with the Fae Commander Kingfisher.
Or you might logically assume she claims Zilverin because that is her homeland and she wants to depose Queen Madra.
But she bypasses both of those options. By the ancient laws of conquest and inheritance, she claims the throne of the sovereign she just executed.
She ascends to the throne of Sanisroth, the Vampire Kingdom, which she subsequently rebrands as the Blood Court. The mortal thief from the starving slums is now the hybrid queen of Sanisroth.
So we have to do a final headcount of the triumvirate before we move on. Malcolm is dead, beheaded by Solas. Bellicon is still very much alive, entrenched on his throne in Yuvalia, plotting his next move.
And what about Queen Madra? The lore is very specific about her movements. Realizing the conspiracy is broken and Malcolm is dead, Queen Madra panics and flees back to the mortal realm of Zilverin to fortify her walls.
Tracking the locations of these monarchs is a guaranteed point on the quiz. Book One concludes with literal violent regime change. It is an incredible escalation of the narrative stakes.
But as we crack open Book Two, Brimstone, the reality that escalation sets in. Ceres rapidly discovers that usurping a throne is easy compared to actually wearing the crown.
Her vampire subjects deeply resent a hybrid ruler. Her new biology means she can no longer step into the sunlight of her former home.
And to make matters worse, a supernatural apocalyptic plague is beginning to ravage the continent. Welcome to Book Two.
The politics take a backseat to plagues, hell dimensions, and the magic of true names.
The first critical shift to note about Book Two, and this is a structural detail that trivia hosts love to test, is the narrative perspective.
Book One, Quicksilver, is a deeply intimate, single POV novel told entirely from Ceres' perspective. You only know what she knows.
But Book Two, Brimstone, shatters that constraint. It shifts to a dual POV structure, alternating chapters between Ceres and Kingfisher.
Which is a necessary structural evolution because they spend a massive portion of this book geographically and politically separated.
Ceres is isolated in Sanisroth, fighting to maintain her tenuous grip on the Blood Court. She is constantly parrying political attacks from entrenched religious zealots within the vampire hierarchy.
Specifically, a leader named Aerith, who violently opposes her rule. Meanwhile, the external world is collapsing.
A devastating supernatural plague known simply as the Rot is rapidly spreading across the territories. The lore indicates that roughly 2,000 people have already succumbed to it.
But it doesn't just kill. It corrupts the very soil and begins spontaneously spawning grotesque monsters.
And the search for the cure to this plague provides the title of the novel, Brimstone.
This is a classic trivia trap. Brimstone serves a dual purpose. It is the title of the book, but it is also the literal physical substance required to synthesize a cure for the rot.
And the sourcing of brimstone is incredibly specific. Where do you harvest it? It can be extracted from the blood of fire sprites.
The text introduces a specific fire sprite named Archer, who becomes crucial to this extraction. However, the sprite blood is finite.
The only place where brimstone exists in abundant raw form is in a significantly more hostile environment. It is found in Hell.
This marks a massive, aggressive expansion of the universe's world building. Book one felt expansive, but it was ultimately grounded in the political deception of the sibling monarchs and the tactile mechanics of unchemical metal.
Book two introduces existential, cosmic, world-ending threats. We are dealing with plagues and literal hellscapes.
And alongside this, the magic system evolves. We move beyond the physical manipulation of metal into the highly abstract conceptual realm of true names and god words.
Let's dissect the mechanics of true names, because it is central to the major conflict in the middle of the book. We have to talk about the Wickerwood.
Belkan, who is cementing his legacy as the most toxic, abusive stepdad in fantasy literature, manages to ambush and capture Kingfisher during a chaotic civilian evacuation.
He doesn't just imprison him in a cell. He utilizes ancient magic to seal Kingfisher inside a massive magical tree located within the Wicker Wood.
Ceres refuses to abandon him. She manages to track his magical signature through a metaphysical plane known as the Dream World. She confronts Belkan and his brutal right-hand enforcer, Aureus.
But she quickly realizes that physical force, and even her standard alchemical magic, is completely useless against the ancient binding magic of the tree.
She cannot break Belkan's hold over Kingfisher through violence. The only way she shatters the prison is by weaponizing linguistics. She speaks Kingfisher's true name out loud.
The concept of the true name is a foundational trope in ancient folklore. Meticulously adapted here. The mechanic dictates that to know a being's true name is to hold absolute, incontrovertible power over their essence.
And this circles back to the spelling gauntlet we navigated earlier. She speaks the name to break the spell. Kaidan Greystar Finvara.
By weaponizing that name, the spell shatters, but it also strips away the illusion of who Kingfisher is. The revelation is that he is not merely a powerful Fae commander.
His genetics are far more potent. He is actually a half-god. And because of this divine lineage, he possesses the innate capacity to wield a highly restricted, incredibly rare form of magic that is exclusive to half-gods, shadow magic.
So she successfully breaks the binding and frees the half-god. But in Caliheart's universe, victory always demands a brutal toll. This rescue comes at a devastating personal cost.
And this specific plot point, the nature of the sacrifice Ceres makes, is something we need to analyze deeply because it sparks massive debate within the fandom.
During the chaotic extraction from the Wicker Wood, Belkan manages to strike a lethal blow against Ceres' animal companion, her pet fox, Onyx.
Yes, Onyx is killed. And Ceres' reaction to this is where I need to push back vigorously on the logic of the narrative. I need to play the role of the frustrated tactician here.
Oh, I know where this is going.
In response to the death of this fox, Ceres taps into her magic, but she doesn't just heal him. The mechanics state that she burns through all of her singular, centuries-lost, world-altering alchemical power to resurrect Onyx.
She successfully brings the fox back from the dead,
uh-huh.
But the magical exertion leaves her completely, entirely powerless.
She burns her monopoly on the world's most powerful magic. I have to ask, I mean, I am a dog owner. I love my dog more than almost anything. But she sacrifices god-level geopolitical shifting magic for a pet.
In the exact middle of an apocalyptic war, while a plague is wiping out thousands and hell gates are opening.
Is this just the ultimate frustrating romantasy trope where emotional attachment completely overrides basic tactical logic? Is it a massive foolish error?
From a purely tactical military standpoint, yes, it is a catastrophic error. It leaves her defenseless when she needs her power the most.
Exactly.
But if you analyze it from a psychological and thematic perspective, it is the most profoundly important decision she makes in the entire series. You have to trace Ceres' trajectory.
Okay, let's trace it.
She began as a mortal street thief, fighting for scraps in the dirt. Within months, she was elevated to an overpowered singular alchemist and then resurrected as a half-vampire, half-fae hybrid queen.
She is undergoing a rapid, terrifying ascension toward godhood.
And as she ascends, she is bleeding out her humanity. She's being forced to make cold, calculated decisions about troops and resources.
So her connection to Onyx the Fox is one of the very last pure tethers she has to simple, innocent affection. It is a remnant of the girl from the slums.
So you see, it's an anchor. By choosing to burn her immense power to save a single innocent life, she is actively rejecting the cold, calculating god-level sociopathy that defines monarchs like Belkan and Malcolm.
Malcolm would have let the fox die without a second thought if it meant preserving his power. Belkan kills purely to assert dominance.
Burning her power is a desperate, violent assertion of her own humanity. She is essentially declaring that she would rather be completely powerless and retain her soul, her capacity for innocent love, than become a god who casually allows the innocent to perish for the sake of the greater good.
It is the thematic anchor of her character arc. Okay, when you frame it as a rejection of the triumvirate sociopathy, it definitely makes her a much more compelling, sympathetic queen. It proves she hasn't lost herself.
But practically speaking, the timing of this moral victory is absolutely terrible. Because the moment she is left magically defenseless, the narrative stakes escalate to their absolute peak.
A Fey warrior named Ren, full name Renfi Cerithian, another one for the spelling list, arrives and explains the horrifying truth behind Kaidan's childhood trauma.
We learn that when Kaidan was a vulnerable child, his abusive stepfather, Belakon, forced him to walk through the Quicksilver and magically oath-bound him to a structure known as the Arjun Gate.
And the Arjun Gate is not a border crossing. It is the literal physical gate to hell.
Exactly. Belakon bound a child to a hell gate. And now, the catastrophic news. The Arjun Gate has somehow been reopened. The containment has failed.
And the mechanics of this failure are very specific. The open gate is currently loosed, spewing demonic monsters into the mortal and fey realms for exactly 3 hours every single day. The world is slowly bleeding to death.
So the board is set for the final act. You have a completely powerless Ceres, relying entirely on her wits and survival instincts.
Alongside Kaidan, who has just accepted his status as a half-god wielding shadow magic.
Together, they have no choice but to physically travel through the Arjun Gate, descend into hell, locate the raw source of brimstone to cure the rot, and somehow find a way to seal the gate permanently.
Which brings us crashing into the cliffhanger that ends book two. And what a meticulously crafted, agonizing cliffhanger it is.
They successfully cross the threshold. They enter the hell dimension. Immediately, they are confronted by two immensely powerful infernal beings.
They meet an ancient dragon named Arasan and a demon named Kray. The tension is unbearable.
And then Kaidan steps forward. He embraces his divine lineage, reveals his status as a half-god to these creatures, and announces to the rulers of hell, his son has come to make a trade.
His son has come to make a trade. It is a line that completely rewrites his lineage once again.
He is bargaining with a divine, or perhaps infernal, father figure in the depths of hell. And he appears to be offering a trade involving a dragon.
And before we can even process the mechanics of what he is offering, the book ends. Cut to black, it ends right on that line.
The audacity of Cali Hart to end a 500-page epic on a mid-conversation bargain in hell.
That cliffhanger alone is the reason why there's going to be a midnight release line wrapping around the block for book three. It guarantees an absolutely massive, rabid audience.
Which serves as the perfect transition into the final, often overlooked section of our trivia preparation. We need to analyze the real-world metadata.
Because any veteran trivia player will tell you, the Quizmasters do not exclusively pull questions from the narrative plot. They love to test your knowledge of the phenomenon itself.
They want to know if you understand the publication history, the author's background, and the real-world metrics of the books.
These are the easiest points on the board, but you absolutely have to memorize them. Let's run the stats. The architect of this universe is Cali Hart.
She is British, hailing from Truro, Cornwall. And a fantastic piece of trivia about her bibliography is that she didn't start in high fantasy.
She previously built a massive career writing dark romance before executing a complete genre pivot to create this fantasy epic.
The timeline of Quicksilver's publication is a fascinating case study in modern publishing, and it is frequently tested because of the sheer velocity of its success.
Quicksilver did not start as a heavily marketed traditional release. It was initially self-published by Hart on June 4th, 2024.
The organic word of mouth was so aggressive and explosive that merely 6 months later, it was acquired for traditional trade publishing.
It was picked up by Forever in the US and Hotterscape in the UK, hitting shelves in December 2024.
In that short window, it rocketed to number one on both the New York Times and Sunday Times bestseller lists, and it secured a nomination for a Goodreads Choice Award for Best Romanticy in 2024.
That trajectory is genuinely insane. From a self-published upload in June to an absolute, undeniable global juggernaut by December.
And when a property moves that fast, Hollywood gets involved immediately. Netflix acquired the film and television adaptation rights that exact same December.
They paid a reported seven-figure sum. The trivia points to remember here are the people involved. It is being produced by Elizabeth Cantillon, and Cali Hart herself is attached as an executive producer to ensure the lore remains accurate.
That timeline highlights the absolute unparalleled velocity of the romantasy market right now.
When a novel strikes the exact right chord, when it successfully blends high-stakes, mechanical, magical world-building with intense, deeply personal character dynamics, the fan base mobilizes and acts as a massive decentralized marketing engine.
Following that success, Book 2, Brimstone, was released a year later in November 2025. And the highly anticipated Book 3, The Resolution to That Hellish Cliffhanger, is slated for November 2026.
If the trivia host asks a subjective question about critical comparisons, the standard industry touchstone that every reviewer cites is Sarah J. Maas's A Court of Thorns and Roses.
But let's dig into a more obscure piece of metadata that contains a hidden trivia trap, the audiobooks.
The narrators who bring these characters to life are Stella Bloom and Anthony Palmini. Now, knowing the structural shift we discussed earlier, you might logically assume that Book 1, which is entirely from Saris's single POV, is narrated exclusively by Stella Bloom.
But the compendium explicitly notes that is incorrect. Both Stella Bloom and Anthony Palmini narrate both books, despite the POV structure of the first novel.
It is a tiny detail that rewards the deeply observant multi-format fan. Finally, before we wrap up this study session, we have to acknowledge the fandom disputes.
I genuinely love this section of the lore compilation because it demonstrates how passionate fandoms act as decentralized, highly aggressive editors. They catch every single inconsistency.
We already discussed the debate over Elroy versus the Ellery typo, but there is also a very genuine, heated debate over the correct spelling of the name of a specific vampire lord who is responsible for turning Saris.
The name is Taladius, spelled T-A-L-A-D-A-I-U-S. But a significant portion of the fandom argues it should be Taladius, dropping the second A.
The guides acknowledge that both spellings are currently in circulation across various editions and wikis. Furthermore, there is an ongoing dispute regarding typographical formatting.
Specifically, where the accent mark belongs in the geographical place name Amontreath.
The crucial takeaway for Trivia Night is that a fair host will likely accept either recognized spelling for these contested names. However, being consciously aware of the dispute, knowing why the spelling is debated, gives you an incredible psychological edge.
It signals that you don't just know the plot. You know the text down to the typographical level.
Okay, let's pull all of this together and visualize the endgame. You are sitting at that slightly sticky pub table. The host taps the microphone. The feedback whines for a second, and the room falls dead silent.
You are completely ready. Your mental map is flawless. Zilverin is the scorched, metal-starved desert. Yelia is the frozen, magical ice.
You understand the complex mechanics of the magic. Quicksilver isn't just a weapon. It opens dimensional portals, forges god swords like Solace, and severely poisons the mind of anyone lacking alchemist blood.
You have successfully untangled the most toxic family tree in fantasy. Bellicon is the abusive stepdad to the half-god Kidan, but the biological father to Everlane.
You know the tectonic twist. The three rulers, Malcolm, Bellicon, and Madra, are siblings who have been price-fixing a global war.
And you know exactly who and what is waiting in hell at the end of Book 2. You are armed to the teeth with mechanical understanding.
You are genuinely empowered. You haven't just engaged in rote memorization of names and dates. You comprehend the geopolitical implications of metal scarcity.
You understand the psychological weight and military consequences of stepfamily betrayal.
You grasp the thematic, character-defining importance of Sayers choosing to burn her god-level power to save a simple fox, prioritizing her humanity over tactical superiority.
You understand the why and the how, and that is how you win.
But before we officially sign off and let you go crush this trivia gauntlet, we want to leave you with one final lingering thought, a profound mystery drawn from the very margins of the lore compendiums, something that hasn't been explicitly answered yet.
We established earlier, through careful deduction, that Adina's spirit, Kidan's murdered mother, lives inside the Quicksilver, managing to speak in riddles through Everlane.
We also know that during the climax of Book 1, right before Saris is pulled into the Divine Realm for her hybrid rebirth, the Quicksilver itself achieved a psychic connection and spoke to her, asking if she wanted to stay.
So here is the philosophical question you need to mull over while you wait for Book 3 to finally drop in November. Is Quicksilver actually a geological metal at all?
Or is it something far more horrifying? Is it a fluid collective consciousness? A metallic river made up entirely of trapped souls, lost gods, and the victims of the original alchemists?
If that theory holds true, it fundamentally, darkly changes our understanding of everything Saris is doing. If quicksilver is essentially a liquid graveyard of consciousness, then when an alchemist commands the metal to form a sword or open a door, are they simply manipulating a natural element?
Or are they forcefully enslaving millions of agonizing spirits to do their bidding? Is Ceres's innate magic, the very thing that makes her powerful, inherently a violation of the dead?
It makes you reevaluate every single action scene in the series. It makes you look at every portal she tears open and every swing of a god sword in a completely different, deeply horrifying light.
It's no longer just a magic system, it's necromancy. That is something heavy to chew on while you wait for the final round scores to be tallied at the pub.
Good luck out there on the 27th. Trust your preparation.
Step up to that table. Uncap your whiteboard marker with confidence. And when they ask you who systematically destroyed the Fae Commander's family, just smile. You know the mechanics. You know the lore. You've got this. Keep diving deep.